Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host and the podfather of your favorite hebdomadal podcast. Oh, I'm glad you're with us. I'd suffer the embarrassment of keto amino acidemia if you brought me down with the sappy idea that you missed this week's show. Here's our associate producer, Kate, to tell us what's going on.
Hey, Tony. Here's what's going on. Honoring others through effective listening. We take a break from our nonprofit technology conference coverage to learn the difference between hearing and listening, how effective listening makes people feel, the four habits of listening, the goal of listening, the importance of the pause, and much more. You need to listen to Dr. Laura Janusik from listeningtochange.com. On Tony's Take Two.
Phew! My book goes out this week.
Here is Honoring Others Through Effective Listening.
It's a genuine pleasure to welcome Dr. Laura Janusik to Nonprofit Radio. Laura is an executive communication expert and speaker who helps leaders maximize their influence. With a PhD in communication and an MBA, she bridges academic research with corporate strategy, specializing in the underrated power of listening to build consensus and drive results. Her work is at listeningtochange.com, and you'll find Laura on LinkedIn, where I did. Welcome to Nonprofit Radio, Laura.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here, Tony. Thanks for having me.
It's a genuine pleasure. We got connected through Bofta Yimam, who I'm close with on LinkedIn. She was a student of yours.
She was. We were at the University of Maryland at College Park. Yes, and she was a wonderful student.
And she has gone on to win awards in journalism. Of course, now she's a personal branding and marketing consultant expert, but she's quite accomplished.
Oh, she is. She was so driven and had so much resilience. And it was interesting because I had her a little bit earlier on in the process where she was still trying to figure out what she wanted. But I will tell you, Tony, once she set her eyes on the news, she just flew. She did amazing things. Yes.
A Murrow Award in journalism and another that I'm not remembering right now, but she was on the show just within the past 2 months or so.
Yeah.
So I'm glad she got we got connected through her because I saw you comment on a post of hers. It might have been about her being on Nonprofit Radio. So it may be the Nonprofit Radio karma that brought us together, this important cultural moment of nonprofit podcast of Nonprofit Radio brought us together. And I believe it was that post.
And then I
saw that she was your student. I thought, oh, this is fun. And then I saw that you're a listening expert and communication expert, and I wanted to have you come and talk about listening. So thank you. Thanks for joining.
Thank you.
What is effective listening?
I don't think we can get to the effective part until we define listening, right?
Okay, what's listening? Okay, great. What is listening?
Yeah.
I love it.
So listening, the way I like to define it after studying it for about 30 years now, because like biology, there isn't one accepted definition. So listening always takes place with a context. However, that said, the context that I always like to put communication into or listening into is communication. So I define communication as sending messages plus receiving messages equals communication. So half of communication is receiving messages. And of course, when we talk about face-to-face communication, that primarily then is listening.
Is listening Is it evenly divided between listening and speaking, 50-50? I always hear that you should like listen 80% of the time or 90% and speak the other 10 or 20.
Well, that gets back to the context, right? So if you're a salesperson, certainly you should be listening 80% of the time. But if you're lecturing, then maybe you are speaking much more of the time and the people in the audience are listening. So again, it goes back to that context. Yeah. And what we're doing, Tony, I would say we're probably going to be 50-50 because at times you're going to talk, at times I'm going to talk. So I think it'll be weighted more towards 50-50 or maybe 60-40 because you are really good at what you do.
I hope it's even better than 60-40. I hope to give you like 70% or 80%. People have heard enough of me. I've been doing this for 16 years. They're bored with hearing from me. Besides, lackluster host, you're suffering under. So I want the guest to shine.
So when we think about listening, then listening is a part of communication. And I think it's a part of communication that is most often ignored or forgotten. I don't think it's as ignored as it is forgotten, because I feel like people perceive listening to be something totally different. Right? I will just sit here politely and smile and do nothing else and just take in what you're saying. But listening really in itself, the goal of listening is to make personal meaning because it's taking place within our brain. So we have to make meaning in our brain. And then the goal of communication is to create shared meaning so that the picture in your brain is as close to the picture in my brain as possible.
So is this the same as like processing? I mean, as you're listening, I would think, correct me if I'm mistaken, you ought to be processing, thinking through what the person is saying. How does it relate to what I understand? How does it relate to what I don't understand? Now that's learning. Mm-hmm. I'm learning. You know, so are we ought to be actively, to me, that's active listening. That's a layperson's term. I'm sure you probably, maybe you scorn lay people's terms about, but to me, that's active listening. When you're not just taking it in, but you're working with what you're hearing and learning.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, there's this component that I like to call the magic triangle. Which means that in research, there are three areas that show significance with each other. So you had mentioned thinking. So thinking is that processing. And we can think when no one else is around. And we often think when no one else is around. So thinking is not listening. However, it's part of the listening process. Because listening, when we're sitting there, we're taking in things from other people. So we have to expand the thinking to include the taking in of the stimuli.
Do you distinguish between listening and hearing?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, for me, and I know it's funny because people oftentimes come at it from the opposite way, but for me, hearing is recognizing that there is a noise going on, and listening is making meaning of that noise.
I always like the Simon and Garfunkel line, people hearing without listening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So hearing is right. We hear a noise that we don't learn from it. We don't, I mean, it just ends there.
Right.
I guess we identify what it is, but we ought to want to do more with each other's in communication than just recognize, you know, that it's coming from Laura Janusik. Okay. That's it. That's all. I heard. I'm a listener. I heard. No. Mm-hmm. Okay. So listening is much deeper than hearing, which sounds kind of shallow.
Right. Listening does include that thinking and making meaning component.
Thinking, making meaning. Thank you. How does, so now can we get to effective listening?
Yes.
Okay.
And when we add effective on there, I think it goes back to that communication. The goal of communication is to create shared meaning. So again, shared meaning is whatever meaning you have in your mind is as close as possible to the meaning that I have in my mind right now.
And how does effective listening make people feel?
Effective listening makes people feel heard and understood, which there's a wonderful quote that says, feeling heard and understood is so close to feeling loved that most people can't tell the difference.
Oh, I love that. It's so close to feeling loved that most people can't tell the difference. Whose quote is that? Can you name?
I can't remember off the
credit,
top of
credit
my
the
head,
person. Okay.
Yeah, I will be That's happy right. to send
all
it
right.
to you.
That's all right. All right. And how does ineffective listening make people feel?
I think ineffective listening makes people feel a lot of different ways, depending on why they wanted to be listened to. But it's all based in feelings. And so they would feel discarded. They would feel unimportant. They would feel like they didn't matter. So all of those sad, awful feelings.
Yeah, that we don't want to leave people with.
Correct.
Regardless of who it is. It doesn't matter if it's a server in a restaurant, a loved one, of course. It just doesn't, those are two ends of a spectrum. Or even a stranger, even yeah. less of a relationship than a server in a server in a restaurant would be like someone on a subway, yeah. or on a plane next to you. You don't want to leave people feeling, rejected, unheard, discard. Well, unheard kind of defines it with the word. That's a bad example, a bad definition. But discarded, marginalized.
Mm-hmm.
These are just, you just don't want to leave people feeling that way, regardless of who it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you and I share that value, Tony, but there are people out there who don't share that value.
That's true. Well, maybe we can convert some folks.
Yes.
I mean, really, it doesn't matter who it is. A little warmth, which we would, in the context of our conversation, would mean a little effective listening, goes a long way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of my values is to make sure that people that I interact with know that they matter to me. And one of the things that I try sometimes when I'm not necessarily feeling connected is I will take a day and I will challenge myself to believe that everyone else has the answer but me. So I have to listen really carefully because I don't know where the answer is going to come from. It may come from the clerk at the gas station. It may come from the cashier at the grocery store. It may come at the person I'm waiting for the bus with. So I just have to really listen to what other people are saying.
So you do this intentionally every several days, or I don't know how often.
Well, I wouldn't do it every several days, but I would say that probably at least four times a year, I will put that intention on for the day.
Why is good listening, effective listening, so challenging?
That's a great question. And there are a couple of reasons for it. Listening is primarily a cognitive activity, meaning it takes place in our brain. When you put it within the context of communication, listening is perceived behaviorally. So I look at you and I judge whether you're listening to me or not. So you have great eye contact with me. You just nodded your head and I assume that you are listening to me. However, we all remember being in high school and fake listening to the teacher who was talking about a subject that we weren't interested in at all. I was great at that. I would always sit in the front row. I would take out my notes. I had my pen and I would nod every so often. I would write, but I wasn't writing notes from the class. I was writing about something I was going to do on the weekend or my to-do list or something that I couldn't forget. So it's really easy for us to fake listen.
You were writing to your crush in the second row.
Well, that could
you had
be.
To, you had to slip the note back there, one row, one seat back, while the teacher's back was turned to the board.
Yeah. So that's one of the reasons that listening is so hard. But the other one, I think, goes back to the individual, because when we make meaning in our mind, we assume that everyone is using the same process and the same information. So obviously they would have made the same meaning that we did. So we just assume that by talking to someone and everyone hearing the same words, that they made the same meaning from those words. However, that's not true for two very big reasons.
All right, well, you got to give us the reasons.
I love that. Well, one of them.
Okay, let's move on.
Our background, right?
I wasn't listening, so let me ask you, how's the weather in Kansas City?
No. Yes.
Because I'm paying no attention.
Yeah.
And then I would get in big trouble. No, come on. Yeah, you got to.
Yeah, so one of the reasons is our background. We're all individuals, yeah. And we've been exposed to so many different things. You know, before we started this, we were talking about how you lived near Kansas City and you knew what the plaza was. And so I could zero in on that because I only live a couple miles south of the plaza myself. So I'm very familiar with what the plaza looks like. But if you've never been to Kansas City, that word plaza wouldn't really have any meaning to you. What is the plaza? So the number of experiences we have and the words that we've put into those experiences or onto those experiences means that we can make meaning of them in similar ways to other people. So, and because we all study different things in college or in trades, we have different, the fancy word is nomenclature, right? So the words that belong in any trade or in any discipline. And that's why we get so frustrated when we go to the doctors, because they use all these big words that the average person doesn't understand that we have to write down and go home and research, and then we're afraid we're going to die. But every discipline has different words. So when you're talking across disciplines to people, we just assume that you have our same background, so you understand what those words mean. But that is not the case. And we also, the other thing that is really, really cool, I think it's really cool. I get very excited when I talk about this.
I can tell you're leaning forward.
I know.
You're smiling even more than you have been. Yeah.
I am.
Your body language is revealing your passion for this second reason.
So this was amazing. It was published in 2020 by Bodhi and a couple of colleagues. And they were able to identify listening habits that we have in the United States. So a listening habit is defined as what we listen to and what we listen for. And I'll give you a quick rundown of the four habits, because there are four dominant habits. So you can be an analytical listener, and that sounds exactly what it sounds like. But analytical people listen for the numbers, the data, the deadlines, and the credibility that supports those things. The connective listener listens for the people and the emotions. The conceptual listener just listens for the big idea. They're not interested in the details, so very different from analytical. They just want to know the big idea so they can take the big idea and they can start brainstorming it for the future. And then you've got the reflective listener, who really wants to help the conversation. So they try to listen to everything and identify what they know to be true based on their experience or knowledge that they have from other people. And what's really interesting, Tony, is, you know, in retrospect, I was not a great teacher for a long period of time because I didn't understand this, because the knowledge hadn't been there yet. But reflective listeners are the ones who oftentimes look like they're not listening. So they're very silent. Oftentimes they'll cross their arms and stare off at the horizon, and they look like they're not listening, but what they're actually doing is processing so quickly, right? Thinking so quickly in their mind and trying to take in the information and get a place for it and also figure out what they're going to contribute to the conversation, which may not be at that meeting. It may be at the next meeting. So I know that you've probably all been in those meetings where you go in, you have what you think is a wonderful meeting, except for that guy over there who never said a word, right? And then you come back to the next meeting the next week, and he's got this really well thought out argument about which way you should go and why. And you're thinking, why didn't you say that last week? And it's because he wasn't finished processing and he needed that time to process it.
You call these the four habits of listening? Is that, what you call them? Four habits. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And they're habits because they're not tied to our personality. They are habits that we can change. And I believe that we develop these habits based, first of all, on our primary caregivers, because they help us figure out what to listen to and what to listen for. And then second, our profession. So when we get rewarded for doing something in our profession, we're like, well, I got to do more of that. I've got to do more of that. So it develops this habit, which means that we ignore the other three habits. So that's where a lot of confusion in communication comes from, because let's say that I'm a very analytical listener and you're a very connective listener.
Connective, yeah.
And we're valuing different types of information.
I hope I'm connective and reflective. That's what I would like. That's what I would aspire to. I mean, I can be, we can be a couple, right? You can have, may depend on the context as well.
Yes, yes.
You might have to be analytical if there's some kind of crisis and you need to know exactly, you know, what's the data? What's the problem? What are people thinking? What should we say? You know, that. So the context, as you had said earlier, you know, may apply to these habits too, but.
Absolutely. Overall,
I hope I'm connective and reflective. Sometimes I find myself having to say, could you repeat what you just said? Could you repeat like your last sentence? Because I lost you. I wandered, you know, and I feel bad, but I also think I'm honoring what the person, I'm honoring our communication, and I'm admitting that I screwed up. You know, I lost you. Hopefully not even a minute. I don't let it go for a full minute, but I lost your last sentence. Could you just repeat, you know, what's happening? Why did my mind leave the conversation for those 15 seconds or so?
Yeah, I can tell you that. That's because.
Well, you're a researcher in these things. Yeah, yes, we're going to talk about research. Yes. I'm interested in what the research looks like around this too. I'll bet it's a little tricky little things. But in any case, you know, so why do I leave sometimes and then have to come back and say, I'm sorry, would you please repeat what you just said?
Yeah. Because your brain can process up to 600 words per minute, and the average person only speaks 200 to 250 words per minute. So your brain has so much more capacity to be able to process. So when you latch on to something and the person speaking 200 to 250 words, you still have 350 to 400 words to be able to process in your brain. So you start going into your long-term memory and pulling out things and making those connections. And then that gets so interesting and exciting that it kind of drowns out the speaker.
Okay. I see. So I've got extra, we have more processing capacity in our brains than people, although I come from the New York, New Jersey metro area, so we probably speak at more like 500 words per, would you say, words per minute? Words per minute? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we're raising the average in that part of the country that I'm from.
You definitely do.
But there are certainly parts, I live in North Carolina now, I think they're slower than New York speaking, we'll put it that way. I don't know if they're below the average, but they're not at the same pace. So, So yeah, I even have more capacity because I'm used to the fast talking Northeasterners, and I live among the slower talking North Carolinians,
mm-hmm.
who I love. It's a different cadence, a different pace.
Yes.
That's it. Oh, thank you. Thank you for, so it's not so bad, and I feel bad about it, but I do the best I can. I say, please repeat. I'm doing the best I can to honor the person and bring myself back into what we're talking about.
Yeah. And you show that you're interested in what they're having to say, right? So you're making them feel good. And I would say that you are doing the best that you can to try to create that shared meaning. So please do not feel bad about it. You should actually feel really good about it that you asked them to repeat what they said.
And no one has ever smacked me or anything, or why aren't you listening? You know, no one's ever said that. So
it's time for Tony's Take Two.
Thank you, Kate. I have a big milestone for my book this week. It has to go to the editor by Wednesday because we have a meeting together on Friday, and then she takes her time to go through the book. But it's a big step, and I'm working assiduously, diligently to meet the deadline. Got to have it to her by close of business on Wednesday. So it's just a big step. You know, then it's in someone else's hands. And of course, it'll come back to me with whatever edits she recommends. But so it's not like it's the final time I'll see it, but it's a big step, completing it and getting it to the editor. Just wanted to share that that's happening this week. And that's Tony's Take Two. Kate?
Does Little Brother have any encouraging words for Big Brother about his upcoming book?
I'm sure the book will be fantastic. I'm hoping there'll be a Cliff Note version for those of us who don't read a whole lot.
I don't know about a Cliff Notes version. You'll have to, I'll give you a briefing.
We've got buku buttloads more time. Here's the rest of Honoring Others Through Effective Listening with Dr. Laura Janusik.
So let's talk about the academic research around listening. Mm-hmm. What is your area specifically?
The area that
that
I started in and did a lot of work in the beginning was how we learn, which you had referenced earlier, right? How just teasing apart this idea that listening is perceived behaviorally, yet we do it cognitively. So I looked at a lot of the learning literature and a lot about how the brain works. And as a matter of fact, when I was getting my PhD at the University of Maryland, I took 2 years off to study cognitive psychology because I figured if I was going to be an expert in listening, I better understand how the brain actually works. And so my dissertation, my area began with capacity, how much capacity each of us has in our brain to manipulate, juggle how many different items. And so I started with this idea. You probably heard about the research where I'm going to give you seven numbers and I want you to repeat back those seven numbers in order. So yeah. Those are span processing tasks. And I was really interested in that because I thought, well, that's not how communication works. You know, Tony might ask me three questions at a time. So I have to juggle these three questions at a time. Will I be able to respond to each of them appropriately? Am I remembering them correctly? Can I pull out the information from my long-term memory correctly? And so I was looking at students' ability to do that and what it might correlate with. I also looked at gender communication because I really, really wanted to try to support this idea that women were better listeners. And I couldn't. Because men and women have no significant difference with what they remember. But women are perceived to be better listeners because women have more of the nonverbals or the interjections like, you know, women do that more, and they've got the nonverbals in terms of eye contact and head nodding that men don't have.
So they're perceived as being better listeners, but the research is that the genders are equal.
In terms of what we remember, yes.
What we remember.
Yeah, what we remember.
What we remember. All right. Oh, that's a measure. Yeah, that's an important measure. Do you know at all know the research of Professor John Hayes at Carnegie Mellon University? Cognitive psychology. Okay. I mean, I graduated from college in 1984. So that I took his course in cognitive psychology, and part of our exam was he read, I think it was something like 20 words or something. And, you know, like we had to hold our hands up or something. And then we had to name the, it was a big number. It was not just six or seven. Like, you know, we learned seven plus or minus two chunks is what you can retain. Yeah. But part of the course was strategies, like tips, you know, to create mnemonic devices, mm-hmm. trying to create connections among these things, you know, but when he's, you know, you get your synapses firing and you're thinking about them in different ways. But when he's saying them, you know, one every like 3 seconds or so, or four, you know, whatever the cadence was, and he did like a string of 20 of them, and then you had to write down as many as you could. That was a part of our exam. So that I thought that was fascinating. But okay, older than dirt now, John Hayes.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily, Tony, because you mentioned those chunks, right? So seven plus or minus two. That was
Still valid? Is that still a valid constraint? We can hold seven plus or minus two chunks in short-term memory?
Yes. However, it depends upon the context, too. So I took that context into communication. And what I found the sweet spot was is 2.9 pieces of information. So in other words, if I asked you four questions at a time, there are a good chance that you couldn't remember all four questions and respond to them.
And also, I remember a chunk, you know, it was the research was, that may have been the term of art, a chunk. But how much can you stuff into a chunk?
Yeah.
If you can stuff four words into a chunk, now you've got seven plus or minus two. Now you've got 28 plus or minus, you know, another eight or so. If you can master the chunk stuffing, you know, chunk is not a word necessarily. It could be many words, could be several numbers, mm-hmm. could be one chunk. And mm-hmm. then you're limited by the seven plus or minus two. I thought there was a whole fascinating. But I remember that exam. I don't remember how I did in it. I think I did well in the course. So I guess I did well in the final exam, but fascinating. You know, just fascinating research. Since that was where your research started in cognitive psychology.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Are you still now, you're an academic now? You're teaching?
Yes or, and no. I retired from Rockhurst University as a full professor. So I'm a professor emeritus. And where I've turned my attention to most recently, you know, I've always been in the profit, nonprofit area for leaders. So leadership communication. But two areas that I'm focusing on more for 2026, one of them is I'm writing a book loosely titled right now, you'll love this, How to Manage Conflict Within the Context of Midwest Nice.
Midwest and South. Well, maybe they're different. Okay.
Well, they are different because the South has a language, and everybody, you know, you can hear the language. Oh, bless your pee picking.
Bless your heart.
Right?
Yeah. Bless your heart. And we know that pretty means much go F yourself. Yeah. Bless your heart. Yeah.
But in the Midwest, we don't have a language like that. It's much more passive aggressive. So it becomes much more about the nonverbals or the lack of communication. And there are so many different ways to interpret those messages, and pretty much none of them are positive, right?
Okay, interesting. All right, so when will you publish your book? What's your
hopefully
goal?
Within, it's 9 to 12 months. right now is school for that one. And then the other area, my mom was diagnosed with cognitive decline about 10 years ago. I didn't get involved until about 5 years ago. I was so frustrated with her, like most caregivers are, after about 3 weeks of just having just, you know, fights with your parent about who's right about what, I finally looked in the mirror and said, Laura, if a PhD in communication can't figure out how to communicate with her own mother, who could? So I had to go back to the research, and I went back to the brain research with dementia, and I've been able to match it up with communication theory to help people explain how communication has to change with cognitive decline. And so what we as a caregiver have to do, because we're the ones who have to change. They can't change. They're already changing. And we just have to adapt to the changes that are in place.
And say the working title of your book again.
Oh, so the book is How to Manage Conflict Within the Context of Midwest NICE. And then I have a workshop for caregivers that has to do with communication and caregiving.
Well, let's make sure you're back on the show when you publish your book.
I will. I would love to come back.
Be in touch, because we have a lot of listeners in the Midwest. Let's help them. Let's help them understand their environment. And a lot of them may be transplants to the Midwest. So they may be in the same conundrum that I'm in here in North Carolina, coming from the Northeast.
Exactly.
Tell me about your background. Were you like the listening? Well, you were the faux listening student in elementary school in the first grade. You probably got all A's. You probably did very well. The teachers liked you. Were you valedictorian in high school or salutatorian?
Oh, I wasn't the valedictorian, but I was in the top 10%, I would say.
Top 10%. All right. 90th percentile is very respectable. Very, very respectable. Were you the child who listened better than others? I don't know how you define that.
No, by no stretch of the imagination did I have any interest in listening. I was the child that always had to be right. So I was a child who was always thinking while other people were speaking on how I was going to top them. And I didn't get into listening.
You were the processor.
Yes. I didn't get into listening until I went to the University of Maryland. And I was paired, my advisor was Andrew Wolven, who was a listening expert. And I told him within 2 to 3 weeks, because Tony, he just always mentioned listening whenever we had a conversation. And I didn't know what it was, but it didn't sound like anything I wanted to have any interest in. So I said to him, Andy, I'm not going to become a listening person. And he was great. He said, Laura, you can do whatever you want to do. Now, I was in my early 30s at this point, and I had a number of years of human resources behind me. So I knew when I got my master's degree, he would have to write some letters of recommendation. So politically, during my last semester, I thought I should take his listening course, right? So he will write me better letters of recommendation. And within 2 weeks, it totally changed my life, because I thought, this is what listening is? Why didn't anybody ever tell me what listening was? Like, I've been the world's worst listener for my entire life. And that needs to change, which is why I got really interested in it. And I got interested in research the same semester. So, and that was the final semester of my master's program. So I just continued on for the PhD.
Well, you were busy being the child who had to be right.
Yes.
Right. So you weren't thinking about listening so much as
being
the head of the class. Interesting. I'm interested in people's backgrounds. Thank you. Thanks for sharing a little bit. You have thinking about the importance of pausing. The importance of the pause. Share, please. Just
yes. I get so excited about this one too, because this is something that I've pieced together through the research as well. I'm not the kind of person that, because my PhD is in communication, I'm just going to stay in the communication research, because listening is part of communication. And as we discussed, listening is cognitive psychology, or thinking is cognitive psychology. So what I have found about silence is absolutely fascinating. We in the United States have what we call automatic responses. So if I were to ask you a question, you would respond on average within a half a second. And I want you to think about that, because I don't know about you, my stopwatches don't even time a half a second, right? No. They time a second. No. So in the corporate world, in the nonprofit world, when we ask somebody a question, they generally respond within a half a second. However, that's an automatic response, because we don't actually start thinking until far after a half a second. And they've done some really interesting research in the area of negotiations. And, you know, they didn't really know about silence then, but they said, okay, we want you to hold your silence after you ask a question. Don't respond for like 20 seconds, 30 seconds, 40 seconds, right?
You mean after someone asks you a question?
Yeah, yeah.
Don't respond. That's a long 30. Don't respond for like 30 or 40 seconds?
Well, or the person who asks the question can't respond either, because in the United States, we get uncomfortable at about 3 seconds of silence. So if I ask you a question and you don't respond right away, what am I going to do? I'm going to re-ask the question. I feel like I'm helping you out. I'm going to paraphrase it a different way, or I'm going to say, well, let's just move on, right? So some of us get a little bit more uncomfortable even before 3 seconds. And I was one of those people. Another reason I was a bad listener, I always thought that people were as uncomfortable as I was. And so I would break the silence and try to change the topic of conversation or ask the question a different way. So one of the things that I work with leaders on is the extended pause. And going back to the negotiation literature, what we found is really the sweet spot of people being able to think about different opportunities and options and create more of a win-win environment in their mind. Like, Tony, I like you as a person. I don't want to dominate you. Let's get both of what we want. So some compromise there. It's about 10 to 14 seconds of silence. So I actually have to go think, right, in my mind before I respond. So one of the things that I work with leaders on is learning how you can, what I call, take silence and give silence. Show that silence in conversation is actually a really good thing. So I can give silence by modeling it for you. So Tony, that's a really good question. Give me a second to think about it, right? So I can model that, or I can say, Tony, I'm going to ask you a really hard question, and I want you to think about this before you respond. So I've just told you to think. And when I say something like that to you, you're going to be like, okay, I better do this better, right? So maybe it's not just my first response, but I'm going to have to add something to that or be able to justify it better. So I love working with extended silence with leaders, because they get so much more out of their people when they do that.
What does the untrained person who hasn't had the benefit of working with Laura Janusik as a questioner think when they are faced with 5, 10, you said as long as 14 seconds of silence? What is the untrained person thinking? They're not going to wait that long, are they?
No. And that's why leaders not only have to learn what it is, but how to do it and how to implement it. Because people are not comfortable with that length of silence in the beginning.
Like you said, give the silence, give the opportunity. Mm-hmm. I want you to think about this. Okay. But the untrained person is going to say, Are you with me? Are you having a stroke or are you okay? You know,
exactly.
What's that? Yeah. Do you need a glass of water?
They
what's wrong?
Jump in. And yeah. What's really interesting in that kind of like, and see, all of my research is all about communication and listening. But with people with cognitive decline or dementia, it can take them up to 2 minutes to go to their long-term memory, retrieve the information, bring it forward, and respond. And we never give people with dementia that long. But when you learn to do that, it can become such a beautiful relationship.
Are you experiencing that with your mom?
My mom passed last April.
Oh,
however,
I'm sorry.
That is the relationship that I was able to build with her. We would have wonderful conversations. They just took a really long time, comparatively speaking.
Okay. That's the degenerative process in the brain. I mean, it's just working that slow, but it is working.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And as you said, degenerative, the degeneration begins from the outside of the brain. So the prefrontal cortex is what's affected first primarily. And that's where our rational brain is. Our emotional brain is buried. The amygdala is like at the top of the spine,
spinal cord,
buried in the brain. And so the emotional brain is what lasts the longest. So oftentimes people with dementia are responding from their emotional brain because their rational brain has been degrading.
Can you share some strategies for the effective listening that we hopefully we aspire to?
For which context?
Oh, okay, good. Well, thank you, Professor. Right. let's take a common nonprofit context where we're a CEO or a fundraiser, mm-hmm. and we're talking to a donor or a prospect. Not necessarily about a gift. It doesn't have to be a gift solicitation, mm-hmm. but we're helping them to learn about the work that we do with the goal of sometime when the relationship feels right, when it feels right in the relationship, to right. solicit the person for a gift.
Yeah.
So we're educating them about our nonprofit.
Yes. Yes. Okay. So
Is that enough context?
That is great context. So that will bring up three things that we've discussed. The first one being they should be talking 80% of the time, and we are listening 80% of the time, right? Or yes, they're talking much more than we're talking.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And second, that pause, the extended pause, if we can learn to bite our tongue when they pause, learn to bite the tongue and get comfortable with the silence, chances are they're going to continue talking. And it's when they continue talking that we really begin to understand and can learn what's most important to them. Because we are not that vulnerable with the first things that we say, but once we become more comfortable, we can get into more of that vulnerability. And that, I think, is a really important element. And the third element, I love this one too. I call it the abstract concrete noun, particularly within nonprofit work. It's very much in some ways like service work because there aren't as many concrete nouns in it. And let me back up. So a concrete noun is a noun that most of us can objectively experience. So if I held this up to you and I said, what is this?
That's a water glass with a straw.
Yeah. It's like a water bottle, right? And I can say the word water bottle, right? Or water or drinking glass. And everybody can automatically get that picture in their head. So that's a concrete noun.
Okay.
Abstract nouns are much more difficult. So we like to show respect to people. respect is that noun, but it's an abstract noun. And what we know is that the definition of respect differs from person to person. So when we're talking about nonprofit work, you know, you're not producing widgets. You're not creating this product of a water bottle. You're touching people's lives in so many different ways, or animals' lives, or the environment, right? But there are so many more abstract nouns there. So the third tip for nonprofit leaders is to really listen for the abstract nouns that the person is using and then ask about them. So particularly if something is repeated a number of times, wow, you said respect three times. What does respect mean to you, Tony? Mm. Right? Mm. And I'm going to find that your definition of respect may or may not be my definition of respect. But if I want you to become a larger donor at some point, I've got to now switch and deal with your definition of respect.
And you're also demonstrating how well you're listening, because your curiosity about the person, mm-hmm. and their interest in your work, and it's effective on a few different levels.
Yeah.
The abstract nouns. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So that's one of my favorites.
Just summarize, just tick off the three. See, because I already forgot the first one. I know the second one was the effective use of pause.
The first one is.
I'm not chunking well at all. You only gave three, and I didn't even do one per chunk.
Well, see, and I said the average was 2.9, so you're right in the game.
Well, I did two. I'm still below average.
Yeah, so the first one was really listening 80% of the time, if not
The 80-20. Okay, yeah. The 80-20 or 90-10. Okay.
Yeah, okay. And the second was the pause, the extended pause. And the third is the abstract concrete noun. And so really listen for those abstract words and ask what they mean by them.
Laura, I'd be grateful if you just leave us with, maybe this is even repetitious, but that's okay, some inspiration for why listening is, and effective listening is, such an honoring practice. Oh, that's good. I'm surprised I came up with that. Such an honor. I'm just amazed myself. I didn't think I would. So, no, it is. It's an honoring practice, mm-hmm. of others. You'll say it more articulately than I do. But please, leave us with that.
I really like honoring practice of others, because what we do is we show that others matter when we listen to them. So we help them feel heard and understood. And I think probably an even better way to say it is the quality of listening determines the quality of the relationship. So if we don't listen well, we're not going to have a good relationship. And in the nonprofit world, if you don't have a good relationship, you're not going to last long.
I'm only going to repeat what you said. The quality of the listening determines the quality of the relationship. Mm-hmm. Dr. Laura Janusik. You'll find her work at listeningtochange.com. And you certainly should connect with her on LinkedIn. Laura, thank you so much for sharing all this. Your wisdom, your expertise is a delight. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tony. It was fun. Thank you for having me.
Next week, mid-level recruiting strategy and tactics. If you missed any part of this week's show,
I beseech you, find it at tonymartinetti.com.
Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. I'm your associate producer, Kate Martinetti. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy, and this music is by Scott Stein.
Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with us next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.